Accession number 28354, Reel 10.
So, William, just before we continue with your main story, I think there's a couple of vignettes which you would like to quickly mention, a couple of addenda possibly, one relating to Admiral Martin, if you'd like to relate that.
I mentioned the letter that I was asked to write by Martin to Mountbatten, offering his resignation, and I wanted to give the reason why he wrote that letter. At the time, he and the Chief of Staff, Captain Eric Bush, had fallen out totally, and Captain Bush was in a tent in Ramree Island, and Admiral Martin was in his tent in Akiam, and the two didn't meet, and the only way they corresponded was by me getting into an aeroplane, a little American L5, tiny little machine, and flying between the two and saying the Admiral says this or the Chief of Staff says that. They really had fallen out, and the reason I imagine that Martin never posted the letter is that they mended their fences and came together again and worked together again, which we found rather unfortunate. But I also mentioned Captain Goodenough early on, who was the very intelligent captain that ran off plans at us in a confusing fashion. He again came into my life later on when he's captain of Newfoundland, and perhaps after this time to give a picture of his character as seen by his ship's company. He was known in his ship, and he's gone out of course elsewhere, and we thought of him in the same way, as God's elder brother, and that really sums up a little bit of his what a sort of pontificating naval officer he had become. Right, we go back to...
Yes, we'll go back, and I think there was just one minor vignette that you mentioned about the Air Commodore, who... because I think in Cox's Bazaar you said that there was a shortage of...
Paddy Vanden was a most attractive personality. You couldn't help liking him. He was a great party-goer and party-giver, and a most ebullient character. And his basher hut at Cox's Bazaar, an area where there were supposedly no women other than the odd nurse, I suppose, that passed through, yet there was always the sound of revelry and female voices and girlish giggles coming from the Air Commodore's basher hut. It was up on the top of a hill, so the sound carried down to us at the lower levels. But he was a great chap.
Thank you. Well, we'll return to the slightly more mundane surroundings, or not possibly with Prince Philip present, of you running your petty officer's leadership course.
I'd rather run out of things of that course, I think. I think
then we can move on to the next.
I think we possibly move on. At the end of it, obviously, when my time was... Captain Hilary Biggs was the captain of Royal Arthur and our superior officer. This is another great naval character. Hilary Biggs collected hats, apart from anything else, and he had in the corner of his room or his office were all these funny hats, which he collected as he went around the world in various jobs in the Navy. We shared a Rolls Royce, actually, which we hired, to go to the reception at Buckingham Palace before the princesses, Prince Philip and Princess Elizabeth's wedding. He and his wife, me and my wife, in this great big vehicle. And we were stuck in Pall Mall in the queue of cars trying to get into Buckingham Palace. And of course, this was the first bit of light and colour that the people of London had seen since 1939. And so the crowds were out watching all the quality, so to speak, going to Buckingham Palace for this do. And Biggs had one of his hats, and which was a sort of Astrakhan hat, rather like the Chechens wear. And he put this thing on as people were crowding around the cars. And he did wonderful sort of waves of his arms, royal sort of gestures to the crowd, enjoying himself hugely. And one lady came up with her small child, lifted him up to the window, and told her to look through the window at the Russian. And this pleased Hilary Biggs. He's a great playboy, tall, handsome, he's a nice looking man with a laughing face. He used to get up at about, his secretary had a terrible time because Hilary Biggs woke at about 5 and did all his paperwork by 6 and started walking around the establishment from then on, being a nuisance to everybody. But anyway, that Biggs came into my life now because the appointer, who was actually then Alistair Ewing, who had been my captain in HMS Offa, was offering me jobs which Hilary Biggs thought I ought not to accept and kept on refusing them on my behalf. This worried me very much. Alistair Ewing offered me the command of a landing craft, an LST, I think it was, and Hilary Biggs turned that down. I didn't mind that because I didn't really want that job, but it worried that somebody was turning down jobs on my behalf, which I didn't think could do me any good. I was then offered a frigate, and I can't remember where it was, in the Far East, I think, a command, and Hilary Biggs turned that down. And I thought this was getting serious. I didn't want to go back to the Far East at all, but you don't turn commands down, particularly at that time when they were difficult to get. And then eventually it turned out he was dead right to keep persisting, and he was determined that my wife and I would get back to Malta. He said, your wife should go back to Malta and see her family. Biggs was a nice man, a good man, a helpful one. And HMS Venus I was offered. And so that was lovely. So in 1948, I suppose it must have been the spring of 48, we went down to Southampton and embarked in Strathnava and went to Malta. We took with us a French nanny, and that's another story. While I was at the Royal Arthur, I saw an Admiralty Fleet order saying that there was an exhibition on the Seine called it was a maritime exhibition, Le Salon Nautique, that's right, and they wanted an officer who could speak French to go and take the Admiralty, the naval stall, and sort of thing, and look after it. And so, having been told I spoke French previously, and having been to France earlier, well, I thought this would be fun. And so I applied and got the job. So for 2 weeks I left Royal Arthur, the Petty Officer School, and ran this little stall. It really was just a stall at the Salon Nautique on the Seine. It was great fun, obviously, being in Paris and going to Folies Bergères and the Lido and all the rest of it. And it wasn't much work, just standing around answering questions. The stall was merely a sort of, it said, La Marine Britannique, salut ses amis français, written over the top with a sort of Battle of Trafalgar scene underneath it, and two sailors who also spoke French to answer questions. We had really nothing much to show. It was a very strange outfit. And actually, Monsieur le Président came along visiting the Salon Nautique and stood solemnly in front of this thing of ours and looked at it for a while, wondering what the hell to say, and then bowed his head and said, "Et moi, je salue la marine britannique." So we had a good salute from that. But while there, my wife sent me a letter, or whatever, or rang me up, or sent me a letter, I presume, saying that the nanny we had, an Irish girl, had become pregnant. In fact, she'd been pregnant when she came to us, which we didn't know, and was off to have her child. And so I started looking around, and there was an army officer I'd met, whose wife I knew had been had engaged a French girl. And I asked her what she suggested I should do. She said, "Oh, well, I met a girl last week who applied for the job, but unfortunately, because she was a very nice one, I'd already given it to somebody else." So she gave me this girl's name, and I interviewed her, and she wanted to come to England. And So I sent my wife a telegram saying, shall I engage French nanny? And she sent me a telegram back saying, yes, but be careful. So I engaged Jeanine, this girl, and brought her to England with me. Now, this was difficult because she had no work permit or anything. And so I wrote her a letter in my best French, inviting her to come to England to learn English in our family, and gave it to her so that she had that when she went through the immigration. And then I separated from her so that we couldn't be seen to, in any way, to be connected, and went through an entirely different part of the immigration, so to speak, at the customs at New Haven. And she came and worked with us, and in due course I got her a work permit and she stayed with us, and she came to Malta with us. So we went to Malta in the Strathnava, and we, of course, my parents-in-law kindly split their house in two and lent us the I can't remember which half of it, the top half of it at that time, that's right, the top half of it. And we happily settled ourselves in Malta. I took over Venus. I went on board Venus about 3 days after we'd got there, talked to the chap I was taking over from, Lieutenant Commander Williams, and officially took over the ship, and then went ashore and refused to come back on board again until the captain's cabin had been cleaned up properly. This chap Williams had only been in the ship 5 months. The previous captain was a Commander Munn, and obviously he'd not been a great success, and that was the reason that I was relieving him, presumably. I don't know the story of why he was actually...
So it was Williams who was not a success.
Yes, Williams was... He'd only been 5 months in command, and there I was relieving him. So, but I never learned the full story of what happened, except that obviously it hadn't gone well in the ship, and you only had to look at the ship to see that it hadn't gone well. It was very scruffy. And... So, as I say, I refused to sleep on board the first night because the cabin was, I reckon, not up to it. And so reminded me of the term officer I mentioned, who said you can, if you possibly can, take over a ship that's had a mutiny because you can't do worse than your predecessor. I wasn't taking over a mutiny, but I was taking over a ship that wasn't at all a good ship, in a, because the captain obviously let it slip. We sailed almost at once, actually, on an exercise, very, very soon after I'd taken over. And here, fates played beautifully into my hand. As we left Malta, Sliema Harbour in Malta, so a fog, really, really thick fog, descended on the whole fleet. And it came to a grinding halt, just outside Malta Harbour. We just stopped in thick fog. And while we were sitting in this thick fog, I started going around the bridge, seeing if things worked. And the first thing I pressed was the make smoke button to the engine room. It was a good time to do it. Nobody would see that I was making smoke in this thick fog. And I pressed the button, and absolutely nothing happened. It wasn't connected up. It was just not functioning. So then I went to the captain's Polaris, that's the gyro compass, in the middle, centre of the bridge, on which there's an azimuth, which, as the captain moved it round, so in the wings of the bridge, another bit of equipment would move round, and the lookout would know where to point his binoculars, or the chap in the director would know to where to point the rangefinder. The captain had seen something. It was called the captain's something point indicator. I can't remember what, doesn't matter. And of course, that didn't work. So I got somebody to unscrew the junction box, which is just below it on the actual Polaris mounting, and all the wires were missing. So this was tremendous. I was able to send for everybody. The engineer officer couldn't make smoke, the electrical officer, no electrics working, the buzzer not working. And there were lots of other things that were inadequate, all in this fog, making a point, so to speak, on first taking over command. As I say, the fog played into my hands. And it was really starting very much from scratch. It wasn't a good ship at all. None of the gunnery worked. It was perfectly awful. But it was something to get right, which we slowly did. The first lieutenant was an unhappy creature. He committed suicide a few years later. I'd no idea that he was as unhappy a creature as that. He just seemed to me a bit eccentric. For example, he was enormously admiring of the previous captain but one, Commander Munn. Obviously, Commander Munn made a great impression on him, and so everything I said, the first lieutenant replied, Commander Munn did this, sir, or Commander Munn would have done that. Indeed, even down to colours, I said, I want this lobby outside my cabin painted ice blue. I can even remember the colour I said. And he said, Commander Munn, and I wanted this. And eventually I got all the wardroom together and said that they'd obviously admired this fellow very much. I didn't know him. However, as far as I was concerned, he was like, they were like Mrs. Danvers, and he was like Rebecca, and in future, when they wanted to refer to Commander Munn, they were pleased to say Rebecca, not Commander. And that was that. I never heard Commander Munn again. It was very strange. He not just the first lieutenant. He'd made a terrific impression on the other officers too, and the chap in between had made none, poor man. So we got rid of Commander Munn. I met Commander Munn years and years later when he was a rear admiral. First time I'd ever met him, and I went out to a cocktail party and said, "You have no idea how I hated you." And he was a very, very surprised man. And I explained. Venus was very good at boarding. This is the time of all the illegal Jewish entry into Palestine, and really the destroyers of the navy. The only thing Venus was any good at was that, running alongside ships and dealing with Jewish immigrants. And really, wasn't a warship at all. And the Mediterranean fleet had got a bit in that state generally. It was a post-war trauma. It wasn't really very efficient at all. But the commander-in-chief who now was there was that man I'd met already who was so pleased to hear that I'd never done a staff course, Arthur John Power, Admiral Sir Arthur John Power, who is quite my favourite admiral of all the admirals I've met in my time in the Navy. He looked like an admiral in my picture of an admiral should look. He acted like one should. He was a very fair man. He was a wonderful leader. And he brought the Mediterranean fleet back to being a proper fleet during his time there. He shook us up. And he shook us up in the way that suddenly one night he sent HMS Surprise, which was his yacht, out without anybody really noticing it had sailed, and then told it to break down, so to speak, and need assistance. And he then, at I think 11 o'clock at night, made a signal to all the ships in the fleet, raise steam, and proceed to see HMS Surprise in trouble over it, and just sat back and watched what happened. I mean, everybody was ashore. Captains were probably in bed with their wives by this time, perhaps some of them, or they were at parties or were in. And we all had, there was a general recall, everybody back to their ships. And he just watched and saw which ships got out first and which ships didn't get out and which made a muddle of it, and shook us fairly. We got out quite well, actually. We didn't do too badly, by no means the quickest, but we did get out, and we had to report how many of our sailors were still ashore, how many of our officers hadn't made it, all that sort of thing. And he had a good check out of his fleet. And he did that again later on. Later on, we were all in Argostoli in Greece for the fleet regatta, a great event which used to happen in the days when ships had boats that you could row. And after the regatta, at, I think it was probably 1 o'clock in the morning, he made a... This is rather complicated. There was a method of signalling by light called the F method. And it meant that the chap originating the signal, in this case the commander-in-chief, made that signal by light Morse four times, and that's all. And the repeating ship, there would be a repeating ship, made it four times, and that's all. And normally when you got a signal, you acknowledged its receipt. In this case, you didn't acknowledge its receipt. The message was sent out broadcast, so to speak, and it was assumed you would get it. You've got it. 1 o'clock in the morning, after all the parties, a regatta ended with a lot of parties. After all the parties had taken place, just the most awful time, really, he said, raise steam and proceed to sea to the entire fleet. In the same way as he'd done in Malta. And everybody raised steam and proceeded to sea. I woke up at 8 o'clock, in the morning, to hear the wash of a ship passing me. And this was HMS Peacock sailing, and I was still at anchor, and I looked out of my scuttle, and except for me at anchor, and Peacock still sailing, and a few ships appearing at the distance, there was nobody there. HMS Venus was the only ship. And then we found the signalman, signalman Kelly, ordinary signalman Kelly, a youngster, a kid, who'd been on watch on the bridge, had seen the signal coming, had started to write it down, had lost his way, and had then panicked. He then asked various ships to repeat the signal to him, and they wouldn't, and didn't. He got one signal saying, if you didn't get that, you're no signalman. He read that one. And there he was, this boy, in the early hours of the morning, still with the signal pad in his hand, in absolute state of complete nervous collapse, poor chap. And in fact, he had got the only bit that mattered. If only he'd come down and told somebody that bit, he'd got raised steam, but then he didn't get the rest. And so there we were at anchor. And we were at an hour's notice still. And there was the fleet disappearing over the horizon. This was terrible. And we raised steam, raised anchor, and went flogging after the fleet. And I got a signal from the commander-in-chief as I rejoined, saying to send my reasons in writing, which was the sort of awful, ominous thing, by such and such a time on return to harbour. And I sent my reasons in writing and trembled in my shoes for the rest of the week or whenever it was, or we were at sea, and absolutely nothing happened. He was so delighted to have caught somebody out. And that's why he's my favourite admiral. Absolutely nothing happened. I got no rebuke, no nothing. I never heard a single thing about it. And I did nothing to the signalman either, because poor chap, he'd had his penance. And years and years and years later, in Trincomalee Harbour, in 1958, I suppose, something like that, another naval officer said, you ought to come on board my ship, and I want you to meet somebody. And in his cabin, having a drink, in came Chief Petty Officer Kelly. As he walked through the door, he put his face in his hands and hung his head. Well, he was very grateful to me because I hadn't broken him. And there he was, a chief petty officer. Nice story. The nicest time I had in HMS Venus was when, at that time, we still had quite a lot of soldiery in Greece. There'd been the communist revolution in Greece and all that, and we had a big military mission there. And they liked to have one ship always available within the close to Greece. So destroyer or frigate or something spent a month there at a time, just going around the islands. And I went ashore on arrival in Piraeus to see the military mission and saw Captain Townsend again. Strangely enough, he was on it. I was told, choose where you want to go. And I picked up the islands I'd like to go to, and they said, well, no, don't go to that one. It's been visited recently by another ship. And so I picked a little circular trip round the Aegean and went to Amorgos, which was charming. The islands then, of course, were totally unspoiled. No tourism, no nothing. They were just poverty-stricken, but beautiful, charming islands. I went to Amorgos and to Skiathos, who is it, buried, the poet. Skyros, I'm sorry, he's buried there. Chios, Samos, and Thasos, all absolutely enchanting islands. And just the ship on our own, going on an Aegean holiday cruise, really. It was lovely, very, really, very enjoyable. Also some awfully extremely interesting ship handling. Particularly, I remember in Skiathos, which is a very, very sort of small harbour. It was quite an interesting stern to the wall manoeuvre to get there. The mayor of Skiathos gave me a case of mastika, the wine. Which of course tastes and smells of my particular dislike, which is chewing gum. I hate chewing gum, and the whole 12 bottles of chewing gum was quite terrible. I had an awful job getting rid of them on anybody. In Samos, I met a Belgian priest who'd been there during the war, and there had been all sorts of. The British had been into Samos and then were kicked out of it by the Germans, and he said there was a troop ship with Germans and Italians in it in the harbour, which was bombed by the British at one time, and as there were a lot of Italians killed, the Germans asked him to do the burial service for these, and I remember this little priest saying, "Comme ça m'a fait plaisir enterrer les Allemands," which was a hardly Christian way to approach it, but it had given him pleasure. He told a nice story about how he had a lot he had a very good wine cellar, he said, and the Italians came there initially, and he said they were very simple people, and when they came to the wine cellar, he stopped them at it and said, "You do not go down there. All Eucharistic wine, all." And he said they didn't touch it, and he kept his wine cellar because they. So he's a cunning little priest, that one.
I do just have one question for you, and that is: you took over this ship that needed shaking up.
Yeah.
Apart from telling everyone to refer to the previous but one captain as Rebecca.
Yeah.
What other steps did you take? I mean, how do you get hold of a ship and restore it?
We did a lot of drills and training and gunnery and
just
all this. I mean, just all the all
plain simple hard work.
We never got very efficient, actually, though not bad. Towards the end, I remember our anti-aircraft gunnery got really quite good, and we shot the drove down when it was being towed, and that was, you didn't often do that. There was a story about that, actually. We did this shoot, and we're terribly pleased with it. You shoot the drove down, that's what you're sort of trying to do, after all. And the squadron gunnery officer, a man called Rupert Wainwright, wrote, you do an analysis of a shoot after it, and go through every blooming thing. And we had a tremendous rate of fire, in that particular one, but some guns missed salvos. This was my fault. I reckoned you must get the fastest rate of fire you can produce, quite independent of whether every gun fires. And this squadron gunnery officer criticized my shoot because of the salvos did not go off as four guns, which is the number we had, going off together, but in a slight ripple, and this was bad. And months later, in fact, I was just still in the ship, this came back from the...